Okay, Tori, there's something about you that I think our listeners need to know when it comes to music. And is it not true that sometimes you think and like compose music in your head? And is that not true?
How do I answer this without sounding like a crazy person?
Like, you have symphonies that you hear in your head.
I do. So I hear music, and a lot of times it happens when I'm falling asleep or I'm really just not distracted from other things going on in the world. And I will just hear pieces of music, and I can pick out the different instruments and the sounds and how they're vibing. But I don't have the skill to then put that on paper. I cannot compose. I haven't read music in a long time. So it's just this weird thing. And now our listeners know about it.
So I guess what I'm saying is, once we have, you know, created the uplink for you into the metaverse, I think that's coming in a future episode. Yep. Then we'll all be able to hear what's in your head.
Wouldn't that be scary if people could hear everything that was in your head?
There's no way that's happening on this end. But today's guest is one of those people who has that God-given talent of not just hearing it, but then really putting it down on paper and composing. And and then to be able to perform these things is just mm-hmm. so amazing. So Eric Jenness is a composer from Canada, and this founder for Concerts for Hope, which honestly was just the most intriguing. If you didn't know the conversation that we had with Eric, and I told you, hey, I'm going to introduce you to a composer who plays the piano around the world. Just paint the picture. What are you imagining?
I think I would imagine someone that is pretty formal and put together, because classical music, it's not like jazz, where it's a lot of free form. There's some guidelines and there's a lot of
exactly
structure to it. Yeah. And so I would imagine
though there is structure in jazz. We'll say that for all of our jazz musicians.
It's almost like you have to know the rules to break the rules. That's what they tell me, at least.
That's it. But you're imagining someone that is more formal, you said.
More formal, just hearing them talk about their music and their craft, especially someone that's been classically trained and has been, you know, in school for a long time learning this. And just there's a different era, like a vibe to it.
Yeah. So.
But your point is that that's not what our guest is,
it's
right?
It's not. I mean, I would say his music is performed in the most unlikely spaces. And the stories that we heard, I'm trying to remember, like, I can't even remember them all. Some of them were like rehab centers and hospitals. The ones that just kept sticking in my brain were the concerts that he had in prisons. We're going back to what mm-hmm. I was asking you to do. I couldn't imagine this classically trained composer and pianist specifically getting permission to perform these pieces in prisons and very intentionally bringing this music to inmates. And the stories, my goodness, the stories that he was telling.
Yeah, if nothing else, just stay tuned for the stories. If you're not someone that would say that they enjoy classical music, I don't want you to write this episode off and think this is going to be music theory, or this is such a story-based podcast of hearing these really specific moments where, whether it's an inmate or it's someone in another country or it's someone in a hospital they're experiencing, maybe hearing the violin for the first time ever.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the emotion that happens.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And I think it speaks to the power of, we could say music for sure, but it speaks to the power of beauty and this idea that light and beauty and life still pushes into the darkness and still pushes into the tough spaces of this world. And And he's, like you said, it's the stories of people's reactions to his music that maybe caught me off guard more than anything.
Definitely listen for those. And for any cynics out there who are maybe hearing this and going, oh, this just sounds like, you know, something that would look good on social media, or this is something that a PR company told him to do because, you know, it's really good. That is so far from the truth. Eric is so humble talking about this, and then to hear him talk about this, but then to go listen to his music and to hear how talented he is, there's nothing showboaty about what he's doing. But he's not getting paid for this. This is just a calling he feels.
Exactly.
To just go out there and do this because he believes people should be exposed to beauty, no matter what their upbringing is, no matter where they're currently living, no matter their socioeconomic status.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you what, a more timely message I can't think of right now, this idea that, yes, we need beauty and joy and passion to just begin to flow back into our world. And boy, if there was a word I would use, it's passionate, because when you start to ask him about what he's doing, he has no problem telling you because he has seen it firsthand. So without really scooping this anymore, I'd love for us to jump into this conversation that we're having with musician, composer, Eric Genis. When we had our friend John O'Leary on one of our podcasts, you were the one he nominated for a Way to Go Award, because nice. That's how we heard about, well, just such cool work that you're doing. And so I'd love for our folks to catch just a little bit of context before we jump into Concerts for Hope. Would you just tell us a little bit about your story and music? There's some fascinating things that I've heard you talk about when it comes to time, for instance, when you were a little boy. And just talk to us about your story and how you got into this field that you're in.
So I started taking piano lessons very, very young. When I was a kid, I grew up in Toronto, Canada. And so the concept of playing the piano, I mean, I grew up with a hockey stick, right? You know, the piano was the furthest thing from my mind. You know, my mother would say, time to practice the piano. I think, well, not when my friends are playing hockey, I'm not, you know? And so, I just started to play one summer and I didn't have much to do. And I just thought, well, you know, as a sort of challenge, as most boys like a challenge, I thought, let me see how good at this thing I can get. And Greg, it just kept going. Like I played and miraculously, it's funny because the more I practiced, the better I got. Imagine that, you know? So it was, I started to really enjoy playing and started to see the sort of the fruits of your labor, if you will, by practicing more and enjoying it. Then I started to write music. And that was the big awakening. In my life, when I was about 11 years old, I remember certain things converging at once. Number one, I loved to play. Number two, I loved composing music. And number three, I became sort of painfully aware that, you know, as I got older, free time would diminish. And I thought, I can write all I want now. There is nothing stopping me. I don't have to buy a house. I don't have to do any of that stuff. Now's the time. And I just fell in love with writing. I spent so many hours by the piano just composing.
So how old were you then?
Oh, 11, 12. Yeah.
So at 11 years of age, you're understanding that time is this resource that is limited. That's actually pretty incredible that at that age you had that awareness.
Yeah.
Your teacher is sensing some of this?
Oh yeah, she's saying, how's Bach and Beethoven coming along? I said, oh, I'm not looking at Bach and Beethoven. Why would I play their stuff when I can write my own? And so, but you know what? You know, the concept of free time is something that I feel is such a wasted treasure in so many young people's lives. You know, I've played for hundreds of millions of people now. And nobody's ever come to me and said, boy, am I ever glad I quit. Or nobody's ever said to me, boy, I can play the violin as good as your violinist because I take world-class musicians on tour. Or I can play as good as your cellist. And do I ever wish I didn't know how to play? Nobody ever says that. But hundreds of thousands of times, how I wish How I wish I never quit. How I wish I never gave it up. Mm. How I wish I could play. And so when I go into the schools, I lovingly hammer those kids. You have free time once in your life. And I'll point out a kid just sort of in fun, sort of say, hey, what are you doing with your free time? You know, like, what? Tell me, what do you have to show for your free time at 14? What can you do well? And very often as well, I spend 3 hours a day playing video games. And that's the wasted resource right there. It sort of turns off the brain. It engages us. We go into this sort of zombie zone, and we don't develop the sort of talents and the abilities that we have, that we've been given by birth. And those are gifts to other people. Like, I take my piano playing now, and I've gone into close to 1,000 prisons to perform. And they're gifts to ourselves. I really sort of bring joy to the inmate, but I bring so much more joy to myself.
Yeah, well, I want to get to these concerts that are happening in, I would call them, unlikely settings. But I have to ask you, I'm just curious, when you go back and look, or even play some of those early compositions, 11, 12 years old, what do you think of those? I mean, looking back, can you give us an observation through the lens of time looking back? What do they sound like?
What I've done is I've taken a lot of the ideas and I think, wow, I really like that. And I've developed it in a much more sort of mature and complex way. So, yeah. So,
that's,
I mean,
cool.
Some of the stuff that I wrote back then is, it's very meaningful to me. But what I do is I don't keep it where it was. I take it and I make it very, very complex. And, you know, I do a violin, cello, piano trio back and forth, and all these musical conversations going on. And but I take those simple melodies that I wrote back then, yes.
Okay, so I want to get into the training for just a minute. So you were at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto, and then you studied at Berklee as well. Is that correct?
I did. What I did was I took a little composition course there. I didn't spend a lot of time there, but I spent most of my time in my younger years on the working on the piano performance work. And once I got that, here's the funny thing. I never looked at another piece of music from anybody else again. From the time I was 22 to now, I've never opened Beethoven. I've never opened Bach. They're worthwhile. They're awesome. They're terrific. However, I use every free moment I have, Greg, for the purpose of writing my own, practicing my own, and performing my own.
I want to say your debut performance in Krakow, Poland, is that how you would describe that first debut performance?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? How old were you? What was that like?
So I've always composed music, and I never thought I would really do this for a living, because nobody's going to pay me to hear my piano music, you know? So what I did was, but I did promise myself from a very young age, even from like 14, that if anybody ever wanted to hear my music, I would move mountains to make it happen. Nothing would stop me. Money, distance, nothing. Someone wants an Eric Jenness concert, they're going to get one. I didn't even know what an Eric Jenness concert was at that point. And so I'm thinking, well, I'm writing my music. And if there's one person that wants to hear me and wants to hear what it's about, now I've always felt very passionate about that. The value is in the music itself. So again, I would travel for one. I would travel for 1 million people. So in Krakow, Poland, what happened was I grew up in Toronto, Canada. And so there was a group of Polish sort of dignitaries, politicians that were visiting Toronto. And one guy said, would you come and just give a concert after dinner? I said, you bet. So I went and played. What I didn't realize, one of the gentlemen there was the Minister of Health. So I performed this concert and he said, would you come to Poland and play? I'm doing this big AIDS benefit concert. I said, absolutely. So this would have been in the 90s. And I went over to Poland and I performed this massive concert. And the reaction of the people was very strong. And that's when I realized, well, there may be something here that I should pursue.
So I'm now at this word beauty, which I've heard you use, other people use, artists in particular will talk about beauty. There's a British scholar and theologian named N.T. Wright that says that beauty is the echo of something deeper. It's something that we need, but it's something that we long for. And so when I hear beauty, it almost draws me in even further to to a deeper part of the story, a deeper part of really what I think life is about. This beauty that you are describing now is being performed in places that I think for many, beauty would not be the word that is used. This whole effort and initiative, can you just take us on that journey, how that actually became something that you're very invested in?
Oh, yes. I feel so strongly about this, Greg. I threw my life at it, really. You know, I do have to define beauty, but for me, the best way to define it is to go backwards. And this is what I mean. I want to talk about the reaction, because I've played close to 1,000 concerts in prisons. I will tell you one thing in common. There is absolutely nothing humanly inspiring in these places. So if I go to your home, or if we go somewhere beautiful, a park, you will sort of stop, you'll observe the beauty, you'll take it in and you'll say, oh, that's moving, that's uplifting. Well, yes, it is. And so when you are in these prisons, they are the ugliest places on the planet. There is absolutely nothing that is beautiful whatsoever. There is nothing about them that you would say, oh, this inspires me on a human level. Nothing. If they're immersed, they are bathed, they are drowning in this ugliness, and then they encounter something beautiful like a profound violinist or a remarkable cellist, they react. And so I want to share with you a couple of the reactions to, first of all, illustrate the effect of beauty and then really define what it is and what art is. Because other than that, if we go the proper way, it's almost academic. I don't want it to be academic. I want people to taste what other people are going through. So I was playing for a youth prison, ugly prison. It was a very heavily ganged area. The leader of the gangs was in the front row. You always know the leader because they always interact. So for example, someone comes into the room, they go and fist bump the leader, high five the leader. They don't care about each other, but the leader, you have to have an encounter with the leader, okay? I know who the leader is. If I lose the leader, I lose the room. And I'm very well aware of that. So we didn't start playing yet, and this guy was going to show me how disinterested he was in my show because he had to be there. So I pulled up a chair right beside him. I said, in 5 minutes, I'm going to be up on that stage. If I don't have your attention, I'm packing my bags and leaving because my show will be ineffective, for one. Number two, I'm losing money as we speak. Greg, in 1,000 prison shows I played, no prison has ever given me a dime. And I was letting him know this. I didn't need 2 minutes. We started playing. Greg, within 10 seconds, this boy sat up. So this boy kept firing questions about the violin through the whole show. How does a violinist play so fast? Where does she know where to put her fingers? What's that bow do? Constant questions about the violin. It was remarkable. He stood up and said, can I hear the violin alone? This young boy put his hand over his heart, threw his head back, started to weep. You do not weep in prison. Greg, I was playing in a super maximum security prison in Northern California called Pelican Bay. And guys were leaving my show. By the time the show ended, about 20 guys had left my show. And there was an audience of maybe 250. So I was noticing this and I made a joke. I just said, in, you know, live, I said, so am I hitting too many wrong notes? Why is everybody leaving my show? And the guard came running up and he said, they're crying and they can't let each other know they're crying. It's a sign of weakness. So this young boy, back to this young boy now, puts his hand over his heart, weeps, and says, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, why have I never heard it before? He's never been exposed to that, which so clearly and obviously uplifted his humanity. What makes a boy stand up and pull and do every wrong thing in prison? What makes him do it? Because beauty goes in. It's like music is a vehicle, somehow transcends the intellect and goes right to that which animates us. It goes right to the core of the human person and uplifts our humanity. Greg, I'm not going to throw my life at entertaining people, but I am going to throw my life at moving and uplifting their humanity and giving hope where there's no hope.
In my language, in my day job, we will talk often about how we are made in the image of God. And part of that is honoring that image in another. And you're providing, I would say, dignity is one of the words that I hear. It's a risk for you, Eric. I mean, can we just say it? You're being incredibly vulnerable in that moment, particularly because it's your compositions. But I love the dignity that is being offered there. And you're right, this vehicle of music is just such a unique language for humans. Are there any moments? I mean, I know you've mentioned this. Let's stay with just the experience itself. Are there any moments where you personally had to remind yourself, okay, I'm going to keep playing? Like, what's the toughest moment that you've had in one of these concerts? Maybe that's a way to put it.
It's funny because I almost want to ask you questions now after that question, because the only people that ask those questions are people that have been through a lot of suffering, right? So that they can identify, wow, that there must be a lot of suffering in your work in order for, you know, the vulnerability. Like, if you're going to do the work, you do the work. That's just it. And doing the work means you're vulnerable to the extreme. I'll give you an example. One concert in Australia was for the solitary confinement, and they weren't allowed out of their building. So I performed in the yard in the dead of heat in Sydney in February, like Arizona in July. You know, it was boiling hot. And there was nobody in my audience. There was 700 guys behind a block of wall. So what happened was, during the sound check, it didn't sound so good. So they let me know. And then when the concert started, though, they were fully engaged and thankful. And they're allowed to buy CDs over there, not to take to their cells, because they could be used for weapons and so on. But they sent them to their families. So my thought is, you know what? The answer is always yes. I will always go. I will always go, dangerous or not. If you're going to do the work, Greg, you do the work, and you remember why you're doing the work. So you talked about at the beginning of this question about the dignity of the human person. You know what, Greg? There are many times at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm driving home from a tour, and I'm asking myself, what are you doing? What are you doing? This is dangerous work. You're coming home with next to no money, you know, because I don't charge. Basically, I just basically tell everybody, you give what you can. I believe in the work. The gift of humanity is that there is this dignity that is unspeakable, immeasurable, sublime. It is just so treasured. You don't earn it. You don't win it. I have a beautiful daughter with Down syndrome. She has it. It's not a matter of the most popular guy and so on. What it has to do with is there is this mystical aspect and reality about our human condition that we have profound dignity. And beauty speaks to that dignity.
So what would you say to someone who isn't a gifted composer, who doesn't have the same, just doesn't have the same gifts that you do, but they're hearing you? And by the way, I understand why O'Leary pointed me towards you, because you guys both just inspire with your stories. And it's like, okay, we got to go, we got to make a difference in this world. But let me just say, for those who are like, wait, I don't play the piano, I don't compose music, How do others bring joy and beauty into their world, into the, I would say, the brokenness of what they see in their world? Maybe they're not going to get invited into a prison, but any thoughts about how each of us are empowered and really called to bring this joy and beauty into our world?
That is a great question. I think about it all the time. Here's what I would suggest. There are a lot of people in our world that are forgotten, like these prisoners, the elderly, the PTSD. I have a beautiful daughter with Down syndrome. You want to make my daughter's life? Call me up and say, Eric, I'm going to come over and I'm going to have tea with Anastasia. Oh, Greg, that would just, she'd be over the moon with joy if anybody did that. And so we've lost the sense of what it means to do things for other people. So my thought is, if you really want to make a difference, and you know, first of all, you have to make an investment of yourself. Love, it's 100% love. Like, I'm going to invest in that person. So my thought is, go visit an inner city school. And, you know, if you're a painter, paint with the kids. You know, mentor one kid, paint with them. If you're a drawer, draw with them. If you read, read with them. If you like movies, watch movies with them. And then teach them through your friendship. First thing of any sort of communicating beauty or anything is, when I'm in front of my audience, I have an opportunity to deliver beautiful music, I have also an opportunity to let my audience know that I care about them as people. And that's why I'm there. My thought to tell anybody, walk into a nursing home, take on one or two of the elderly, walk into a grade school and you know, go through the proper channels, become mentors to these kids, go to Big Brothers, go to Big Sisters, start mentoring people, which means a personal investment. Then you can talk to them. Then you can teach them about the difference. So I never say you should do this or you should do that. I just show them and say, what do you think the right thing is?
Well, I feel like what you're doing is we're coming full circle to this idea of providing dignity and entering into this and acknowledging the worth of another and meeting them where they are in the story, with a word I would use is grace. If I could, I want to just ask you a couple of questions about the music now. I don't want to get too nerdy, but I do want to ask you a couple of questions. We live in an age and an era of headphones and earbuds and kind of isolated experiences of music. I'm curious, as someone who sees the power of music, can you speak to the power of the, of course, the piano is an acoustic instrument. The violin is meant, you're meant to experience this in the physical energy way. Can you speak to the importance of experiencing this together versus each of us listening to our own stuff on our own earbuds and iPhones? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that is a real important topic. So if you asked me, Eric, what's the ideal world of the musician? I'll speak for me. Music is meant to be 100% live. It is. So the CDs are great. The recordings are great. I'm not going to put them down. Well, no, let me put them down a little bit. They're sterile. They're absolutely sterile. So when I'm performing in concert, it is me, my musicians, and they're performing my music, but it's live. There is a connection between what's going on. Music is, it's not a live organism, if you will. You know, it's not like a live person or something. But every time I play a piece of music, it's a bit different. There's always a certain excitement and energy about sharing the music directly with an audience. When you have people in a room, believe it or not, audiences feed off each other. If there's a room of 1,000 people and there's only 100 people at my show, and let's say I have a room of 1,000, there's an energy that will not be there, and I can't make up for that. But an audience collectively, when they are together appreciating a work, there's an excitement that they all share. And especially when the work tends to be emotional and touches them individually based on their own past, their own experience, and how they intercept it, it may not be the same for each, but certainly the driving emotion is there. It's almost like everyone's going through something together, regardless of what they believe, regardless of political affiliation. There is something about beauty that uplifts collectively, and we're meant to participate in.
When you speak though about this, I'm absolutely tracking with you, because again, in my day job, I've seen us lose the live experience, the communal experience together of what we would call worship, and there is something really powerful when people are gathering together. And it is, you're right. We're experiencing it each differently, but we're all experiencing it together. And there is something about being reminded that we're not alone in this world. And I do think music is one of those ways that this happens. For the people who are, there's two really obvious questions I need to ask you before we get into some of the fun stuff at the end. And it's really, we'll have this in the show notes, but for people who, A, are wanting to experience your music. So here we are in the land of Spotify and iTunes, and you know, we've talked about how live music is important, but if someone cannot experience your music live, is there something you would say to someone? Start here, listen here, and maybe start the journey here with me. Is there a particular work or a particular album that you would suggest someone start with? So that's the first question.
I just finished a recording, and the recording is called Redemption. And so Redemption is, it's a CD, it's like an album, and it's on Spotify, it's on all those things. To me, it's I love this album. I have not recorded in 10 years, not because I haven't been composing, but Greg, I haven't recorded in 10 years because if there's $10 in the bank, I have a choice, record or go and play in a prison. When COVID hit, I couldn't go into the prisons, and you know, and so I'm starting to go in now, which is very, very grateful for. But I was able to do this recording, and it's a very emotional recording for me because of all the experiences I've had over the last 10 years of playing so many prisons. And it's not me, Greg, it's not me. There's nothing special about me, but our culture is starving for beauty. It's like we're starving for nutrition. You know, when the body gets nutrition after being starved for so long, it reacts. One of the first times I played in a prison, this man stood up and yelled, "I forgot what hope felt like."
Okay, I love it. I love it. And I love the word because that is something we long for. And I guess really, again, in the show notes, we'll talk about this, but is there something that you would just say, hey, if you want to support Concerts for Hope, what's the best way for somebody to just take a step towards this initiative and what you're doing?
The best way is to always host a show because then I'm giving you something back kind of thing.
Okay.
If people want to donate, 100% of what they donate, Greg, goes towards these prison shows, rehab centers, inner city schools, Concerts for Veterans, and Concerts for the Elderly. I just say go to ericgenis.com.
I appreciate your time and sharing your heart, sharing your vision, sharing a little bit of what you're doing in the world. For fun, the way we wrap these things up, and I gave you a little heads up on this, if you were nominating someone for a Way to Go Award, now that you are a recipient of a Way to Go Award, you didn't know that, who do you want to give a shout out to? It's a person, it's an organization, it's an artist that's just doing great things in this world.
First of all, besides John O'Leary, because John O'Leary's an incredible man, right? John O'Leary's just an incredible
Yes, he is.
I think if everybody knew John O'Leary's work, this world would be a far better place. There's this one organization called, it's an organization I'm going to give you and a man's name who runs the organization. It's in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's called New Freedom. New Freedom is, this gentleman had a vision of buying, he's an ex-inmate. He went to an investor and they bought a hotel, a Sheraton hotel, and he's filled it with inmates who are getting out and he's going through rehab and giving them very, very intense help so that when they get out, they will be successful. And he's having remarkable success. New Freedom is, and his name is Joe Chiappetta.
Brilliant. Okay. Rapid fire, here we go. What's one person that has made a lasting impact on your life?
Okay, it has to be my wife. My wife's walked down this journey with me, very tough. I've been on the road, we've miscarried children. You know, my wife, when it gets really tough, and everybody likes to do the work like prisons and so on until it hurts, and then they quit. My wife hung in there. My wife believed in me. My wife just, you know, keep going, Eric. I know it's tough, keep going. So it has to be my wife.
That's good. That's good. What's one thing you're loving these days that we should check out? It could be an artist, it could be a series on Netflix, it could be a book, it could be something that's helping you. What's one thing we should check out these days?
So I never read because I'm too busy, but when I'm on the road, I listen to audiobooks. And there's one audiobook that I've listened to for the last 3 months, maybe 4 months. It's called The Imitation of Christ. It was written in the 1600s. And all it does is give short 2 minute, 3 minute reflections. So you listen to one reflection, but the reflection really speaks to your humanity, hits right to the human core. I have to really say this book has made an incredible impression on my life. So I'd have to say The Imitation of Christ speaks to my humanity in ways very few things do.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Thank you so much, Eric. I mean, you are one of those people that we will move into life with more hope. And I appreciate everything that you're doing. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And I can't wait for folks to just become more involved with your work and what you're doing. And one more time, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for listening to a Godzillion in One podcast. Subscribe, share this episode with a friend, and head over to gregholder.com for the show notes. And as always, stop and notice this week the shockingly and seemingly endless ways to connect with each other, this world, and the God who made it all. We'll see you next time.